Good morning, everyone. This is Will, and you're listening to Two Man Congress. Perfect. So let's hop right into things. What I want to talk about today is kind of an extension of what I did during the first solo episode, which was the freedom of speech. But this time we're going to be focusing on location, because that is the first thing that the Supreme Court looks at when determining whether or not what kind of level of protection speech should get. Before we hop into it, I just want to mention a little something from the last episode, which was, is the Constitution living or dead? And I feel like it wasn't really fair to just give you one option or the other option to say whether you should just follow originalism or contemporary methods, because that's what we talked about during the argument. But yet there are seven types of arguments out there that the Supreme Court justices use. And interestingly enough, I mean, this is all based off of politics, because the Supreme Court justices, even if they are originalists, are going to adopt some methods of contemporary methods to meet their political ideology. And same thing with contemporary methods, or those Supreme Court justices who use contemporary methods, they're going to use some forms of originalism if it fits their political ideology. So here's a third proposal, just something, and I don't want to try and share or push my opinion on to everybody, so that's why I'm giving this third proposal. But what the proposal is when we are interpreting the Constitution, to stick as much to originalism as possible. If it's not possible, obviously there are other methods that have been found constitutional ways of interpreting the Constitution. But the Constitution is not a dead document, as a lot of originalists like to say. There are ways of amending and changing the Constitution. And in fact, there are four ways discussed in the Constitution of how to change the Constitution, or rather, to how to create an amendment. So the first way is to use two-thirds vote of both houses in the Congress, and then that's ratified by state legislatures in three-fourths of the states. And that was used for the majority of amendments. That's been used for 26 of the 27 amendments. The other ways that you could do it is two-thirds votes in both houses of Congress, and then ratifying conventions in three-fourths of the states. So that's different, conventions versus legislatures in the ratification. And that was used for the 21st Amendment, which was the repealing of prohibition. Now, the two other methods actually haven't been used, and it's because it starts with a constitutional convention at the request of two-thirds of the states. And there's a whole lot of reasons behind that, and that's why it's actually so difficult to amend the Constitution, because there's so many fears about what's going to happen if you were to call a constitutional convention, and it's so hard to get two-thirds of the houses of Congress and then three-quarters of the states to actually ratify those amendments. That's why it's so hard. But there is an outline given in the Constitution of how to make these changes. So the proposal that I'm suggesting right now is originalism, because there is a way of amending the Constitution, and so that should be left to the legislatures and not the Supreme Court. Okay, so let's go ahead and just hop right into what we want to talk about today, which is freedom of speech, but we're going to talk about location, because as I mentioned before, location is the first thing that they look at when determining how much protection the speech is supposed to get. Just as a review of what we talked about in episode 2, which is what constitutes free speech, there are three kinds of hierarchy of protected speech. There's most protected, somewhat protected, and least protected. The most protected are content-based speech, meaning regulations can't go against a specific religion or specific standpoint. There's somewhat protected speech, which is content-neutral, meaning that regulations can be made regarding permits that don't target a specific standpoint. And then there are least protective, which obviously these are obscene material, criminal speech, such as perjury or libel. So just like there is a hierarchy of protected speech, there is actually a hierarchy of protected places where that speech can take place. In other words, speech may typically be considered free speech, may not be considered free speech in a certain location. And so let's just look at those a little bit. There are four places. The first one is a traditional public forum. Second is a designated public forum. Third is a limited public forum. And the fourth is a non-public forum. Looking into each of these a little closer, traditional public forums are parks or streets or sidewalks where anyone can just bump into anyone and exchange their political views without any fear of government regulations. Now, designated public forums are areas such as city auditoriums or public meeting rooms where it's necessary to have restrictions. This could also include large event gatherings in a park that require a permit. And it's necessary because you got to maintain the numbers to make sure that things stay under control and nothing goes wrong. Now, a limited public forum are places that the government has opened up for a specific purpose. These are like state universities, where the specific purpose is for an education. So for example, a university could put up a website and they could regulate any of the comments that are criticizing a university coach because that's not related to the purpose of the website. So that's an example of a limited public forum. And a non-public forum is a category that encompasses government facilities that have not traditionally been used for public discourse, and then private property where the owner has not given consent for public discourse. As far as the government facilities and that includes jails and defense plants, nuclear facilities, and so on. And then the private property, that also includes private forums such as social media and private universities. All of these forums receive a different level of protection. The public forums, the traditional public forums, receive the highest protection, so on and down the list to designated public forums, limited public forums, and non-public forums. Non-public forums receiving the least protection if an issue was to arise with the constitutionality of a regulation regarding the First Amendment protection of free speech. So now that we've talked about some of the locations, let's just give an example where this was taken into place. And in this case, we're going to talk about McCollum versus Coakley, which was decided in 2014. But before we do that, I just want to say, obviously, the Supreme Court went into a whole lot of an analysis regarding the location and then what kind of tests that they were going to use and then what kind of speech was being protected. Instead of focusing on all that analysis to make the decision, we're just going to focus on the first step, which is the location, and we'll state that. And then at the end, we'll just say what the Supreme Court ended up deciding about the case, because obviously it went into a different the next steps as well. So we'll go ahead and have a quick little break, and then we'll come right back to McCollum versus Coakley. Before we go ahead and hop into the case, let's just talk a little bit about Patreon. Patreon is the way that you guys can support us in our endeavors here at Two Man Congress. It's pretty simple. You just go to patreon.com/twomancongress. And you choose a tier to sign up for, and those tiers have certain benefits that allows you early access, or it allows you to vote on what kind of topics that we're going to talk about, or allows you to make certain requests on what we're going to talk about. Each of those tiers is a judicial, executive, and legislative, each representing one of the branches of government. So I thought it was, well, Chad and I thought it was a really fun idea for us to do that, and a really cool way to engage the listeners. And so we hope you go to patreon.com/twomancongress to support us there so that we can continue doing what we're doing, because we enjoy what we're doing. But we also want to make sure that we're making an impact on helping you guys to be successful. So yeah, go to patreon.com/twomancongress. That's Two Man Congress, spelled TWOMANCONGRESS. And we'll go ahead and hop into this case now. All right, let's hop right into this case. So McCollum versus Coakley, the way that we're going to do this is we're going to talk about what regulation was being contested and why it was being contested. We're going to talk about who McCollum was quite thoroughly, and we'll briefly talk about Coakley because, I mean, obviously that's the other party of the case. And then we're going to focus on the location, and then we're going to focus on the decision. Okay, so McCollum versus Coakley. First, in 2007, Massachusetts amended its Reproductive Health Care Facilities Act, and this was an act that had been enacted in 2000 to deal with clashes between abortion advocates and pro-life advocates. And so this amendment, what it did is it made it a crime to knowingly stand on a public way or sidewalk within 35 feet of the entrance or driveway to any reproductive healthcare facility. And the original version of this only created a 6-foot no approach zone within the facility. And so what this did is it expanded that really far. And McCollum was a 76-year-old grandmother who engaged in pro-life sidewalk counseling. So sidewalk counseling, instead of carrying a sign or shouting at people their beliefs, was a form of, was a method of trying to dissuade people from receiving an abortion by offering literature and by offering alternative solutions other than an abortion. Because of this amendment, she felt it made it really hard for her to practice this, and so she sued the Attorney General, which was Martha Coakley, and claiming that this law violated her First Amendment right, and what she wanted the Supreme Court to do was to keep the state from enforcing it. So first, this went to the District Court, which upheld the law, and then the Court of Appeals upheld the law. And so McCollum took it to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not this law was constitutional. So let's hop right into the location of this. Where was she doing a lot of this stuff? Well, the law talks about obstructing while knowingly standing on a public way or sidewalk. And that's where McCollum was doing most of her counseling, was on the sidewalk. And so she felt like this really limited her space, considering how this was a traditionally public forum. And the Supreme Court agreed with her in this context, was that this was a traditionally public forum, because the sidewalks are to be expected as the place where you can engage in conversation, where you're going to bump into somebody, and you can just talk. Now, it makes sense that this place, that this barrier would prevent people from holding signs or obstructing the place from it continually, but what McCollum was doing was walking with the person from a considerable distance to the abortion clinic as she tried to dissuade them from receiving an abortion. So having passed the first step, the Supreme Court decided to continue to examine the case because of this public forum. This case received strict scrutiny, meaning that the law had to pass a high test in order to be considered a constitutional law. And so now they get into the speech and they talk about whether or not it's narrowly tailored, whether or not this is content-neutral law, which ultimately they did decide that it was a content-neutral law, but because it wasn't narrowly tailored, meaning they hadn't really tried any other alternatives, it was an unconstitutional law. So the Supreme Court said that this law was unconstitutional. So why is this case important, and what implications does it have for you? Well, if you remember all the way back to our first debate, we talked about social media censorship and whether or not social media should have to abide by the First Amendment. In that debate, or rather at the end of that debate, we suggested a policy that would hold social media platforms accountable for anything that wasn't constitutionally, well, for speech that was constitutionally protected. So social media platforms would still have the right to be able to censor material that was unconstitutional, but they would also be held liable if speech that was considered constitutional was held, was censored by the social media platforms. And so the reason why this is important, why I'm bringing that up, is because location is the prime part, why the prime challenge to the constitutionality of a law, of a policy that was like that, if it were to be passed. Because if it were to be passed, then undoubtedly the social media platforms would go to the Supreme Court saying, hey, they can't do this because, well, we're a private platform. And private platforms have a lot of authority, or rather speech on private platforms aren't heavily protected because of the private organization. And so what would end up having to happen is that law would be challenged, saying, is this a compelling governmental interest? And is this narrowly tailored to where it doesn't infringe on the right of the private organization, so that the conflict here of free speech is resolved in a meaningful way? So that's where location really comes into play with this argument. But we don't really know what's going to happen or what the Supreme Court would say until that were to happen. And so that's where you come in. You would take this to your legislature and you would talk about getting this passed so that it can be taken care of, and the Supreme Court would eventually hear it, and we would say, okay, yes or no, this is unconstitutional, or that yes, this is constitutional, and the Supreme and social media platforms would have to abide by that. And that's the difficulty of politics and the simplicity of politics. Politics is very simple. You as a constituent have an idea. You take it to your legislature. The legislature proposes it to Congress, and then it goes to Congress and the Senate and the President, et cetera, until it either becomes a law or doesn't become a law. If it becomes a law, what happens then is, well, often a party is going to determine, well, it's going to challenge the constitutionality of that law, and then it's going to go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, yes, this law is constitutional, or no, this law is unconstitutional. And that's all politics is. It's super simple. But yet we complicate it so much because of these party ideologies and identities, and we make it so hard to get things done because of all these differences of opinion that we have. But it doesn't start if you don't do something. So you have to do something. And that's what we're encouraging you to do, is actually take action. I mean, this policy might not even be a very good policy, but we don't know if we don't actually try. So that's something that we would encourage you to do, is if you like the policy suggestion, or if you like any other policy suggestion, just take it. Take it to the legislature. See what they think. And vote in people who you think might vote for it. And that's how politics works. And that's all it needs to be. And that's how you fit into this situation. All right, that's everything. And we'll go ahead and close. And we hope to hear from you on how we did, and what you liked and what you didn't like, and what you would like us to change, or what you would like us to continue doing. But that's it for this time, and we'll see you next week. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is, if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join LawSchoolersPro, and you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't are pre-law materials, and the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice. And with that, the fourth thing is if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.